ABC, Los Angeles.
Celebration 25. Our year for celebrating. So keep communicating with KABC Talk Radio 79.
We're celebrating a love affair that's been going on for 25 years. Los Angeles and KABC. Let's keep on caring. Let's keep on sharing with
Bill Jenkins.
Welcome on this Saturday night to Open Mind. I am Bill Jenkins, and for the next 3 hours, we're going to require that of you, an open mind. We're going to talk about your mind and perhaps what's behind your mind that makes it work, that makes you work. Quite often makes you run amok, I suppose. We'll do that on this wonderful world we call Open Mind on this Saturday night, so come on out. I want to read you a little something, if I may, from Jack Anderson, just to start the evening. A decade ago, an American agent penetrated a previously unknown top-secret Soviet military base in the Urals. The spy described the base in minute detail, according to the Central Intelligence Agency report. He charted railways, machine shops, laboratories. He even reported that an unusual proportion of women were working at the facility. America's agent was Patrick Price. He's a bulky, balding ex-police commissioner from Burbank, California, the spawning grounds of some of Hollywood's most successful spy movies. During the entire mission, Patrick never left the comfort of the Stanford Research Institute laboratory in Menlo Park. How about that? That you could sit here in the United States and go through and describe in minute detail the confines of a secret Soviet facility. To talk about that with me is someone who has been very, very, very involved with the activities of the Stanford Research Institute. He's coming back to Open Mind for an encore performance tonight. He is the author of one of the finest books on this matter of psychic ability and ESP that there is. It's called The Mind Race, the race that the United States has with the Soviet Union on using your psychic abilities and using them in a way that will hopefully be beneficial to us, Dr. Russell Targ. Russell, welcome to Open Mind.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here. We like to think that the mind race is a race that people have with themselves to develop their psychic ability rather than a race between nations. In our trips to the Soviet Union, we find that the Russians are every bit as interested in developing and understanding psychic abilities as are the Americans. Both nations have learned a lot about how to elicit psychic abilities and help people function psychically. We're unfortunately neither of us very astute right now about how psychic functioning works. The kind of psychic functioning that's been going on and that Jack Anderson is talking about, we call remote viewing. In remote viewing, a person sits in the laboratory or in their armchair at home, and that person is able to close his or her eyes and describe what it looks like and what's going on at a distant location.
And do it accurately.
You find that people are able to come up with surprisingly reliable and accurate descriptions of these distant locations.
And we're not just talking about something that's going on. We're talking about research in which you were deeply involved with that was done under laboratory-controlled scientific conditions under the aegis of the Stanford Research Institute. So it's not flip of the hat time here, Russell. It's fact time, right?
That's right. Frequently, we would have a government scientist from Washington come to the laboratory and want to see something psychic, as they would say. And during our first few years of work at SRI, we would have one of our experienced remote viewers describe where the contract monitor had gone to hide. After a couple of years of that, we found that the person would go back to Washington and he and his boss would figure out that it was a trick and that they had been deceived. So in more recent years, when I was at SRI, we would have one of the visitors learn to do remote viewing himself in the laboratory and he would then have the experience of describing where we had taken his body. And people were able to come up with strikingly accurate mental pictures of this distant location. And, of course, I as an interviewer would never know where the traveling person had been taken. I would just ask the person in the laboratory with me to describe how he felt and to describe his mental pictures as he was trying to experience what his friend was doing. I would not say, for example, what's the name of the place, what's the function of the place, because what we have learned is that people are able to describe their experiences, which is something that people do all the time, because psychic functioning is a non-analytic ability. It's not like counting or doing arithmetic or reading. It's a feeling experience. And if I can get the person to describe how he feels and what he's experiencing and what the shapes and forms are, even fairly skeptical visitors are able to learn to do very well. And in The Mind Race, the book we've recently published, we give recipes for the kind of psychic sit-ups, if you will, that a person would do to get their mind in shape to learn to do remote viewing. And this kind of experiment, which we first started describing in 1972, has now been replicated in laboratories across the country. So this is not just some peculiar California activity, but it's something that has been done in Princeton and University of Chicago and most recently in the Soviet Union.
Well, the bottom line here, Russell, is that this matter of remote viewing is an ability that is common among all of us if we learn to develop it. Some people have a little better access to that ability than others, but I think it's more by doing.
That's right. The principal thing we found is that psychic functioning is not exotic. It's not something that you have to look into your crystal ball or wear a turban or take drugs to accomplish. The most surprising thing and the most robust of the things we discovered is that psychic functioning and remote viewing is not only easy to do, but it's a fairly common ability.
We probably use it in our everyday life more than we think.
Oh, I'm sure that business people especially use psychic ability every time they have to make a decision in a case where they can't figure out analytically what the answer is. I think people use it to make business decisions and to find parking places.
Well, I haven't been able to get those parking places down, Russell. You're going to have to work with me a little bit so that I can find them.
Well, the problem in finding parking places is that I would tell you to relax and close your eyes, and you immediately get into a problem driving down La Cienega with your eyes closed looking for a parking place. It leads to other problems.
A few could. With you, I see, is a lovely lady who is involved with an organization and with an effort, I think, that has a great deal of merit. Judith Orloff, a psychiatrist. Practices here in Century City.
Yes.
And a part of the Spiritual Emergency Network. That has a very unusual sound and ring to it. What kind of a spiritual emergency might people be involved with, Judith?
Oh, there are many different kinds of spiritual emergencies, ranging from psychic experiences that are unwanted and that can really take over a person's mind so that they're uncomfortable with it.
What kind of psychic experiences are unwanted that people have?
Oh, there are many, many different kinds, one of which is the most disconcerting, are auditory hallucinations that come in, or voices that come in and direct a person in terms of their behavior, what they should do, what they shouldn't do, give them information about future events. And this type of information can come in very rapidly, and it's very difficult when a person begins to have this experience to turn it off. And oftentimes this can be interpreted as a psychotic break, and the person will be taken to the hospital.
Are these voices mischievous usually, or are they benign, or are they helpful?
Usually the voices in themselves are benign and helpful, but if the person is not grounded psychologically, they could turn into a very fearful experience for the person, so that they'll become more paranoid, more unstable, and feel unbalanced so that they just can't handle it.
Where do the voices come from?
There are many different kinds of voices. If one is having a pure kind of psychic experience, the voice is a directive voice from within the person.
It is a part of their own consciousness or subconsciousness or something.
It's something that the person is picking up on in terms of information that's coming in. And where the information is coming from is unclear at this moment.
Is it a form of channeling by any chance?
It can be a form of channeling.
Hmm.
In terms of where it comes from at a given moment, from a given direction, that's unclear to me.
How often do we see these cases where people start hearing these voices?
Oh, very, very frequently. I see this in my practice, maybe 3 or 4 times a week.
Hmm. And certainly it is disquieting to whom it happens to.
It's disquieting to a lot of people. There are a whole new group of people who are more aware of these kinds of experiences, which are often labeled Kundalini experiences. And they have a different type of perception and a different type of grounding in terms of dealing with them. And so when a person is having these breakthrough psychic experiences, they can also speak very lucidly about them and seek help at that time and not really lose their grounding or require any kind of hospitalization to keep them stable.
What other kind of experiences are people having, these psychic experiences? You have voices, you have a Kundalini experience, which is an energy kind of thing that makes you tingle all over, I suppose.
The Kundalini experience is an energetic experience, and often people describe it as quite frightening if it comes unasked for. Kundalini usually is taught with a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and usually very, very slowly, because if it does come through unasked for, it can be, again, very frightening for the person who's experiencing it. And different people have described it as very, very hot energy coming up from the base of the spine, going up to the neck and up through the head, which is disorienting. It often stimulates a fear of death. People find it disconcerting in that they become unbalanced and uncomfortable physically. Oftentimes pain will be evoked. Dizziness, lightheadedness.
What causes a Kundalini experience? I know that in yoga and some of the other things, you strive to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly you want it on a controlled basis. You don't want it just hitting you all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Where and what are we dealing with when we're dealing with a Kundalini experience?
Mm-hmm. What the Kundalini experience is a release of energy. And it's energy that the body usually does not know how to deal with. And through a given meditation experience, the teacher will teach the students to deal with that energy as it is released in little spurts. Mm-hmm. When a Kundalini experience comes into a person and it's unwanted, that's where the problems usually occur. And the Kundalini comes in for no known reason. If the person has not been working with this at all, and all of a sudden they start to experience this, this is often the most frightening. And where it comes from, I don't know, but some people do experience this without any kind of warning.
What are some of the other psychic phenomenon, if we can call it that for the moment, that people experience that they may need to talk to somebody about that?
Well, probably the most common psychic experience that bridges Judith's interest and mine as well is precognitive dreams.
Mm-hmm.
In both the practice of psychiatry and in what people tell us in the laboratory, we have the common experience of people having a very vivid dream on Sunday night and then Monday afternoon actually experiencing the content of their dream. And one of the things that we've been able to do is to identify the properties that these dreams have to separate them out from, say, wish fulfillment dreams or anxiety dreams. So a person who's interested in exploring his or her precognitive dreams can learn to tell the difference between those unique dreams that have information about a future experience from clear dreams that are just pertaining to their wishes or fears.
Do we have any idea what causes a person to have a very accurate precognitive dream? And what is the mechanics there, the mechanism? Do they go forward in time? Have they broken down the time-space continuum somehow, and they're in the processes of the mind, what's happening?
Well, probably the hard question is what causes a person to have a precognitive dream. I was trying to think what an answer to that would be. When people, in order to do psychic functioning, you have to clear your mind from the mental noise of what you think the answer will be, of the environmental noise around you, of the mental noise generated by the person who is with you or interviewing you. When you're asleep, your mind is generally clear of these kind of analytic noises and environmental noises. So you're much more open because the slate is clean, your mental slate is clean, so that images can come in. Now, these images, of course, can come from your unconscious, which is what the whole basis of dream psychology is based on, or they might come from an experience you will have at a later time. It's as though you're reading your own mind in the future or experiencing today from a mental process what you will experience perceptually tomorrow. And what people can learn to do when they have these dreams or after they have these dreams and wake up is tell that the dream has a unique signature that I was talking about. That is, no, the dream is not about something related to their work or something that they're anxious about. It's not related to something that they wish would come true. So it's not a wish fulfillment dream. But on the other hand, it is a very clear dream and has some kind of bizarre elements which they do not associate with belonging to themselves or a memory. So if they have a very clear dream about standing on a train platform and seeing a bright yellow train coming into the platform, and they've never seen a bright yellow train in their lives, and they don't normally stand on a train platform, they might tell somebody that they had a very unusual, unaccountable dream that had all these strange elements. And one of the things that the dreamer will learn is to identify those dreams that do have unusual elements and be surprisingly accurate in identifying precognitive dreams from the wide variety of other kinds of dreams they can have. So that occasionally a person will miss a precognitive dream, but he can become extremely accurate in not telling people about dreams which are not precognitive. So you have a very low false alarm rate after you've become interested and started taking account of your dreams.
Those dreams are a part of psychic functioning, and there are many areas and levels of psychic functioning. It is a natural part of all of us, and it's something that we want to introduce to you tonight and certainly discuss with you tonight on Open Mind. And to do that, we have Dr. Russell Targ with us, who has spent many, many years of extensive research, notably at the Stanford Research Institute. You now have your own organization.
That's right. We're working with Bay Research Institute, which is a nonprofit organization in San Francisco. In 1982, my partner Keith Harari and I left Stanford Research Institute because we wanted to write about our work and disseminate the findings that we had accumulated over a decade of research. And the way that it was easiest for us to do that was outside the confines of an institute that was supported principally by the government.
Why I'm so happy that you're here, though, Russell, is that we can talk about psychic functioning here, and we can talk of it about it from a very, very scientific, well-researched, controlled, researched point of view. Rather than from a point of view of, hey, I know people have this, and it's not, we're not speaking of things mystical or metaphysical here. We're talking about some raw science. Also with us is Dr. Judith Orloff, a practicing psychiatrist here in Los Angeles, who has certainly been in touch with and brushed with Dr. Targ on this matter of psychic functioning, the problems that psychic functioning, which is sometimes unannounced, can bring to you, and you'll have a chance to talk to all of them. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. It seems like the thing to me, Russell, as we came on, you showed me the Jack Anderson column, which I read from as we opened the program tonight. You said if you had put this information that Jack is talking about in your marvelous book called The Mind Race, that you'd have been put in jail for passing on classified secrets. What did Jack have to say here that was classified?
Well, as you know, I can't explore classified material with you over the ABC radio network.
Why not? We do it all the time on this show.
Well, Jack Anderson probably has more resources available to him than I do. What Anderson described is some activities that, of Pat Price, who was a police commissioner of Burbank before he came to work with us at SRI. Pat was one of the most psychic individuals that we ever encountered. He functioned as a psychic person every day of his life, whether he was doing experiments or not. He would come in during the meeting of OPEC when they first started and said, amazing things going to happen. I see these oil chieftains meeting, and I see their meeting broken up by other people. And that happened the following day when some terrorists broke into an OPEC meeting. And during the Yom Kippur War between Israel and the Arabs, he said, don't worry about it. I know we've been following it all week. I see a ceasefire happening no later than Sunday. He gave us a note to that effect. On Sunday evening, there was a ceasefire. So Price felt that he was in touch with all manner of world events. In Jack Anderson's column, they give a description of Pat describing Soviet research and development facilities sitting in Menlo Park. I really can't comment on that beyond what Jack Anderson has to say. But last fall, we went to the Soviet Union as guests of the Soviet Academy of Sciences and worked with a famous Soviet healer, a lady named Juna Davidashvili, who is known to us because she is said to have helped keep Premier Brezhnev alive during his latter years. And we wanted to do some remote viewing experiments over the distance between Moscow and San Francisco, which is 10,000 miles. We had been in the Soviet Union the year before, and we were again invited by the Academy of Sciences to do some demonstration of ability experiments for them. And we went to Moscow and convinced Juna that it would be interesting for her to learn how to do remote viewing, which is to sit in her apartment in Moscow and describe where my partner Keith Harari was sitting in San Francisco. She was reluctant at first because she had a very comfortable relationship with the Academy of Sciences as a psychic healer and really didn't need remote viewing since she didn't know what it was and was nervous about all these Americans. But my daughter Elizabeth, who is a Russian translator, was able to convince her that we would take responsibility for the whole activity. All she had to do was follow our instructions and describe her mental pictures, and everything would be okay. We got her agreement to do this surprising thing, and in two experimental trials, she was remarkably successful on consecutive days in describing what it looked like where Keith was hiding. In one case, she said that he's standing in a small plaza near the water, near a little building that looked like a cupola. And in this case, he was on Pier 39 in San Francisco in a little plaza standing in front of a merry-go-round. And she went on to say, very peculiar, I see some pointy ears and glass eyes. It looks like an animal's head in profile. And the photographs of Keith that we have show him standing next to a wooden horse in the merry-go-round. The next day, she gave us a description of a totally different place. And of course, in these experiments, I have no idea where the person is hiding 10,000 miles away. Next day, Juna in Moscow said that Keith is at a large building devoted to a person who has died, and there's a famous book written about, a famous book associated with this place. It was a large San Francisco church. It didn't occur to her that the book might be the Bible and the man who had died might be Jesus, but she just described in these very allegorical terms and said, and by the way, people go in and out of this place, but nobody lives here, and it looks like they're having a party because there are a lot of candles lit. So we felt that both of these instances gave us good examples of psychic functioning. Obviously, she didn't name the place, but of all the things she said, almost all of them were correct. So of the things she could have said at random, we were able to evaluate her 90 statements about these two places and found that both of them significantly matched the intended location. So in these experiments for the Soviet Academy of Sciences, it's more than our impression that she did well, but we went to great pains to scientifically analyze what she had to say and how her statements matched the intended places rather than a wide variety of other San Francisco landmarks. So what we conclude from this is that psychic functioning has no problem in spanning the 10,000 miles between San Francisco and Moscow, at least as so far as our experiments show, with this lady in Moscow describing events in San Francisco.
It's amazing, and it's fascinating what you are unearthing here, and the way that that could be helpful to all of us, not only as individuals, but as a society. This ability to look with great accuracy at far distances. Do we see the ability for us to have this remote viewing capability, but also to view into the future and into the past? We're talking about precognitive dreams. What about a precognitive view of something?
Well, we've done a lot of experiments with precognition. What we find is that people are able to transcend not only space, but time as well with their remote viewing experiences. We first discovered this, again, with in experiments with Pat Price. We were sitting in an electrically shielded screen room, and Pat was to describe where the head of the laboratory had gone to hide. And Pat was supposed to describe where he would be in a half an hour. But only 5 minutes after the laboratory director had left, Pat said, "You know, I can tell you right now when they're going to be when they get there." And he said, "They're going that way," and pointed north from our laboratory in Menlo Park. He said, "I see lots of little boats and a jetty and some motor launches." And he went on describing a little dock and boats and a building that looked like a Chinese pagoda. And this was before the target was in fact selected, because our laboratory director wanted to choose something entirely by himself. So he followed the flow of traffic and turned at random for a half an hour and wound up at a boat dock in Redwood City. And the place that he arrived at remarkably accurately matched what Pat had described 30 minutes before it was even chosen. So that was the first example of precognition or precognitive remote viewing that we had experienced. Since then, the dean of the engineering school at Princeton, Dean Robert John, has chosen to explore precognition in the laboratory at Princeton. And he recently published a paper with 230 precognitive remote viewing trials that he analyzed with his computer-based evaluation scheme. And he found significance at more than one in a billion of the accuracy of his experiments as compared with what you would expect by chance. What that means is that there is no question that something like precognition can be found under laboratory conditions of the strictest kind. So what we conclude is that a person who is interested in developing his psychic abilities or his remote viewing abilities is able not only to look for a lost bracelet or a distant oil well, but can also look into the future to find out what events are lying await for him.
I wonder if that's good information that I have sometime.
Well, we think it's pretty good. In the fall of 1982, we developed something called associative remote viewing, which allowed us to make forecasts in the silver commodity futures. It's as though, and before I tell you how to do this, I'll tell you the outcome, so you can decide whether or not it would be interesting. We made 9 forecasts in the fall of 1982. We were forecasting changes in the price of a commodity known as December silver, which is traded on the Amex, which is American Commodity Exchange in New York. And we would forecast on a Thursday what the change in the price of silver would be during the following 4 days. That is, what is the change between Thursday's close and Monday's close the next Monday? In the 9 forecasts we made, and these were made by my partner Keith Harari, all 9 forecasts were correct. 7 of them were executed in the market, and we made well over $100,000 for the investors who are willing to go along with the psychic forecast.
What do they think about that at the Securities and Exchange Commission?
Well, they were pretty amazed. We made a film with Nova, which was shown a number of times, and they interviewed traders who said that it was impossible. They couldn't find words strong enough. But our experiments were subsequently replicated by researchers at Stanford Research Institute, and they did...